This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For-profit higher education has come under intense scrutiny from the government lately. There's growing concern about low graduation rates and overall quality. It's a worry because of the amount of federal money that goes to these schools. For-profits get 70 to 80% of their revenue from federal student loans. Because of that, the Obama administration tried to ensure that students and the government are getting what they pay for. The administration set a new federal definition of academic credit hours as well as accreditation requirements. But North Carolina's Virginia Fox sponsored a bill that passed in the U.S. House that would strip away those standards. Senate hasn't taken it up yet, so we don't know what's going to happen. But the political battle raises questions about the changing state of higher education and what role for-profit colleges will play in that. Joining us now by phone is Jack Henderson. He's the president of Brookstone College of Business, a for-profit college in Charlotte and Greensboro. He also serves as the president of the North Carolina Association of Career Colleges and Schools. Welcome, Jack.
Good afternoon, Frank, and thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure to have you here. And along with us is Chris Fitzsimon, who is the founder and director of NC Policy Watch. Welcome, Chris. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We're taking your phone calls this hour, 877-962-9862. Have you had an experience with a for-profit college? How did it work out for you? Call us at 877-962-9862. Email sot@wunc.org. So, Jack, let me ask you, first of all, a for-profit college or university, how is it different from nonprofits?
Well, in many ways, Frank. First off, the schools vary in size from being very small, 100 or so students up to larger institutions, but I think that the big difference is the program offerings. For-profit colleges focus on career training, offering programs where there are jobs that are in demand.
So give us an example. Your colleges, for instance, what can students expect there?
Allied health is a growing field, one area that is a bright spot in the current economy, and we offer programs in that area.
Now, I have to say that does sound a little bit, your description in that particular example sounds a bit like what community colleges are set up to do, vocations, training, skills in jobs and careers, and they make adjustments to the changing marketplace.
We would be very similar to a community college.
Yeah. Well, now, for some, there's some confusion over the quality, and I think this is sort of at the center of this debate right now, quality of education at for-profit institutions versus traditional ones. Are for-profit universities subject to the same educational requirements and accreditation standards as nonprofits?
Well, Frank, for-profit colleges that participate in the federal student aid programs are regulated by a triad. And that is a network of organizations. It includes the Department of Education, state licensing authorities, and accrediting bodies to include both regional, national, and programmatic. So the same entities perhaps that govern many of the our counterparts in the nonprofit and public sector, we answer to as well.
So, Chris Fitzsimon, in terms of standards and accreditation and all of that, can we compare? I mean, is it apples and apples when we try to do a comparison as a consumer, as a student?
Well, I think there are a lot of things to consider. I think there are certainly for-profit universities or for-profit colleges that are doing a good job. I think the concern is that there are some that are not, and it's much harder to deal with them than it is a traditional public or private nonprofit university. I think that's why you see the federal government investigating and finding abuses in the for-profit industry, again, among some for-profit colleges, not all of them by any means. The General Accounting Office did a study a few years ago that found a lot of problems, false promises made to students, things I would consider as predatory enrollment almost, making false promises, trying to get the scholarship money, not so concerned about a student after they are enrolled, as long as the Pell Grants or whatever grants are coming in. And I think that the quality, the marketability of the usability or the usefulness of a degree, the ability of a student to graduate, and then what sort of loan burden they have when they graduate. The loan burden at for-profit colleges are often 4 to 5 times higher than the nonprofit or the government sector. And again, nonprofit colleges have for-profit colleges have a place, but I also think we need to invest and do more to invest in our community college system that you mentioned and some of the other schools that are around.
Why is it harder to get at them? You said that earlier. I mean, there are certainly nonprofits that are not living up to standards or they're not very good. Why is it any easier to get after them than it is for a for-profit?
Well, I think there's the accrediting agencies and the tradition, the way that those things are handled is a much different mechanism. In North Carolina, the legislature last year created something called the North Carolina Board of Proprietary Colleges, which is part of the community college system. In other states, that's been a first step toward having a board of proprietary colleges that is independent and makes its own rules and regulations. In North Carolina, that board is dominated by folks who have a business interest in the who run for-profit colleges or universities or have significant investments in those. So it's sort of the fox guarding the hen house. And I think that's the big concern is the proper regulation, the proper protection for students, the proper protection for as any consumer product. I think there's a separate issue about whether we, you know, the philosophy of having for-profit education. And I think, again, some do it well, some don't do it so well. But, you know, I think you do need to think about when the goal of an institution, it exists to make a profit. And that's its goal, not just simply give kids a good education.
Jack Henderson, some of the criticism is that students at for-profit colleges take out big loans and that their debt burden is much higher than that. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, you know, student loan debt and high tuition are problems that plague all of higher education, not just for-profit sector. And the for-profit sector accounts for only about 17% of the national student debt, according to Mark Cantrell, it's at finaid.org.
I have to point out at this point, it's also only 10% of the students. So if 10% of the students have 17% of the debt, it means they have a disproportionate share.
But I'd like to address Chris's comment about the State Board of Proprietary Schools, and particularly the North Carolina Association of Career Colleges and Schools. Over the last several years, we have gone to the General Assembly and ask for changes in the statutes. The first thing that we did was the creation of a student protection fund, and that is a statewide fund held at the Treasury that licensed schools pay into each year to make a student whole in the event a school closes and is unable to perform a teach-out or transfer the students to other institutions.
Well, what about credit hours, too? Do all the credit hours transfer from a for-profit to a nonprofit?
Well, credit transfer is always up to the receiving institution. Unfortunately, in many cases, they do not. And that's a problem, again, across all sectors of higher education. We experience that. Many of the schools in North Carolina will only accept credits from a regionally accredited institution. In the southern region, for a school that does not offer a degree program but instead awards certificates and diplomas, there is no authority, no regional accreditation available.
Could you become part of the regional accreditation process that the nonprofits are a part of? Just say we'll subject ourselves to those standards.
Most of them are regionally accredited as well.
Right. So, but if could for-profits say, look, we want in. We want to be part of this.
Yeah,
we'll be inspected just like the rest and graded.
Again, it depends on the area of the country the school's located in. Here in North Carolina, we're part of the Southern Association. And the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools does not offer any accreditation to a school that does not offer at least an associate degree.
Are you what about the idea of the role that for-profit institutions are taking? I mean, are they, because certainly nonprofit universities are making adjustments all the time. They're becoming more flexible, more online programs, all that sort of thing. What do you think is the unique role of for-profit institutions? What are you doing that the nonprofits aren't?
Well, I think, we've been doing that all along, Frank. We've been keeping an eye on the marketplace and tailoring our programs to fit the marketplace. We've offered schedules that are convenient to our students. The majority of our students are non-traditional students, adult students that have jobs or families.
So in addition to, and I'm trying to get to some of the criticisms and to get your take on them, because in addition to a disproportionately somewhat higher debt burden, there are also lower graduation rates. What's happening there?
The graduation measure is right now not an accurate measure because it only judges the success of first-time, full-time students. And the majority of our students tend to be part-time who return to school later in life. And the current graduation rate calculation is based on traditional students at traditional schools. Now, the department did recently come out and say that they were going to look at revising that, and we actually applaud that.
To come up with a different standard so that there's
right now it's sort of one mold and not everybody fits into that mold.
Chris Fitzsimon, would it help if, getting back to the accreditation question, if these schools were simply all part of the same accreditation process?
Absolutely. I think if consumers, students, and their families and people in North Carolina knew that the schools met the same basic standards for instruction and accounting and a lot of other things, I think that would go a long way. One of the concerns that I have seen raised by a lot of folks is the aggressive marketing, again, of not all for-profit colleges, but around the country. And there have been abuses where people were literally misled or talked into signing up so the school could get the federal grant money with students who may not be able to make it, who the college knows would have a hard time there. I think that's why you see a lot of members of Congress especially concerned. That adds, and the more likely those people are to borrow that money, the more likely they are to be part of our loan default problem.
We will continue our conversation on for-profit colleges and universities with Chris Fitzsimon. He's founder and director of NC Policy Watch. Jack Henderson joined us by phone. Jack, thank you so much for being with us. Jack Henderson, president of Brookstone College of Business, for-profit college in Charlotte in Greensboro. And our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. For-profit colleges take in about $35 billion a year, and they spend a good chunk of that on advertising.
To the 5 a.m. scholar, we've been inspired by you, inspired to grow from our technical school beginnings into the kind of university and graduate school you need today.
Lisa Rain. John
Rogers. Daniel Garcia.
The degree of Bachelor of Science.
Master of Business Administration.
This degree is granted
bearing the seal of Strayer University.
Check out ecpi.edu. You could go from zero to bachelor's in 2.5 years.
Now, the ads are designed to appeal to non-traditional students, but are these schools a good alternative to traditional higher education? Today we're talking about for-profit colleges and universities and how they're changing the educational landscape. With us is Chris Fitzsimon. He's the founder and director of NC Policy Watch. And joining us now in the studio is Jane Shaw. She's president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education. Jane, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Taking your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. Have you had an experience with a for-profit college? Did you choose one over a traditional university and why? 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org is our email address. So this all got started because of the Obama administration's imposition of regulations on these for-profit schools. Standards. Should the government be imposing standards, Jane, on for-profit colleges?
Well, the government should certainly have standards when it provides funding, when it provides loans and grants to students. And whether or not they need these extensive standards for universities is another question, because in a more or less free market, the competition would determine whether there's an effective teaching. The problem is that there's an enormous amount of federal funds going into both for-profit education and also other higher education.
So, and that does raise the question, Chris. These are only standards for for-profit institutions. The question is, why have they not been imposed federal regulations and standards on nonprofit institutions, Chris? Should they be there as well?
Well, I think, first of all, there are standards that public institutions have by virtue of and a lot more accountability measures. The University of North Carolina, for example, is funded and regulated by the state government that funds it, the taxpayers, and that's us. There are similar accountability measures in place for traditional nonprofit private institutions like Duke University, close to where we're sitting.
Yeah, but they're not government regulations, right? I mean, there are accreditations and all of that sort of thing.
But they get a significant. I mean, they have some regulations they have to meet, but most of it is from the traditional, I think, higher education community. I think the difference here is that you're having institutions that are funded primarily by convincing people to enroll. That they're aggressive marketing. We heard some of the commercials. There are stories that have been found around the country where students are literally sold a bill of goods, and I think that's the dilemma. We have you mentioned community college earlier in the show. We're cutting funds for community colleges right now that provide a very cheap, very good vocational education program for kids in North Carolina, and they don't graduate with $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 in debt. They can get become a mechanic and a nurse and a lot of other things. So it's a little bit bizarre to me that we're cutting funding for that at the same time folks are opposing regulations to make sure that people who are paying far more are getting the education that they believe they should.
And Jane, I guess the big question is it's not so much that there's a for-profit institution that could advertise the way it wants and have whatever standards the market will bear, but so much of their funding, 70-80%, actually comes from the federal government. This is a very heavily subsidized private market.
Well, it's interesting that some studies have been done, one by the Atlanta Federal Reserve Board, which found that when you take the total picture, for-profits actually do not get as much funds as public universities and even, in many cases, nonprofit universities. The reason for that is that their only funding, and of course it is enormous amounts, comes through the choices made by the students. Those students can go to community colleges instead with Pell Grants or with student loans, and and some of them are choosing to go to for-profits. In addition, we have an enormous subsidy of state universities. I mean, just incredible. And state universities do not pay taxes, whereas the for-profits are companies, and they do.
Well, I this is a little bit off the subject, but I always have to object when people call it a subsidy. The state doesn't subsidize higher education. The state owns the institution, and it's guaranteed that we provide a free public education to citizens of North Carolina as free as practicable. That's in the founding document of North Carolina. So I don't want to leave people with the impression that we subsidize higher education. We are the founding document of the state says we provide that as a service, and we hope that we have a fair tax system that then pays for that for everybody. I'm alarmed at the tuition increases, but I would object to the term subsidy.
But the central question in any event is when public money goes to any kind of institution, what are the standards and what are the expectations that go along with the money? And if you don't want to meet the standard, fine, but you don't get the money, and then figure out another way. And if the market's great enough and the service you're providing is so good, you know, you shouldn't need our help, and students will flock to the doors. 877-962-9862. Chris is on the line from Durham. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was calling in because I've had the rare experience of having gone to a private nonprofit, a for-profit, and a community college in this in our area, and had vastly different experiences with the with those. When I went to the for-profit, basically after leaving the private non-profit university, I did not have a job and was looking at getting a certificate in computer animation, which was a hot top field in the mid-90s, I guess, and found that there was a really aggressive marketing towards getting a degree or a certificate in that. Was able to get. They basically said, you know, you can get these grants, you can that'll pay for it all. Basically, I just had to show a short portfolio, which, you know, in retrospect was a pretty so-so portfolio. Was able to come in and then had $15,000 worth of grant to pay off and no job after that. Ended up later going to a community college and with a much smaller tuition fee, was able to get accounting classes, and I'm a CPA now. So I found that the community college system is fantastic, and it seems to be a much better, even, you know, looking at things that are on career paths, both the for-profit and the community college system, I would sell the community college system anytime.
All right. Well, Chris, that's just sort of one account and one anecdote. But, Jane, let me ask you this. Just in terms of efficiency, we're seeing graduation rates that are not as high. Low graduation rate is one of the issues here. The cost is about the same for the private schools, and they rely a lot on federal money through those student loans. Is this really inefficient? The private market is supposed to be more efficient. Why isn't it cheaper with better outcomes?
Well, the unfortunate thing, and I agree that this is certainly a criticism of for-profits, they do tend to price what the market will bear, which is just what traditional universities do. But they are pricing themselves a little bit under the traditional universities and generally more than the community college. So someone who can find, as Chris did, a really good community college program may well be better off. And the Pope Center, by the way, is a great fan of community colleges because we see them as providing direct education at much lower cost than the universities.
Well, you know, so there was Chris on the line. She had all those choices before her, ended up at the community college, which ended up being the better choice. But something, and she mentioned the marketing. There was something about those ads. I mean, this is a hard thing to get you to respond to, but even though those choices were available to someone who ultimately took it and realized she had a better deal at community college, there was something about those ads that took her to that private school first.
I agree. They're very effective, apparently, in ads. Now, that doesn't mean that the other universities, the traditional universities, aren't marketing themselves, but they are marketing to a different group. They're sending lots and lots of brochures to well-off students who do well on the SATs. So they're marketing as well. What's different about these organizations is that they're marketing to a working group, primarily perhaps low income. And that's another reason why they do end up having, for example, higher default rates. But I do want to mention that the graduation rates, while when they are compared, as your earlier speaker said, sort of on the bachelor's level, for example, they don't do that well. 22% graduate typically compared with about 60% in public universities or other nonprofit universities. But in the case of associate's degrees, their graduation rate, according to a study by the American Enterprise Institute, is much higher than community college graduation rates. So they are better at more vocationally oriented projects. And again, there's a whole variety. There's good and there's bad, no doubt about it.
Well, Chris Fitzsimon, let's talk about that. Isn't this just a matter of weeding out the bad ones? And can't most of your objections be taken care of through fraud legislation? There are already laws on the books about lying to people about what you can do for them.
Well, there are. I think that we need to be very vigilant about the regulation. It's interesting we haven't brought up the fact that a lot of these for-profit colleges spend a significant amount of the money they get from the federal government or of their budget in lobbying Congress against the very regulations that would ensure this accountability to people. Senator Hagan recently introduced a bill to restrict some of these for-profit colleges from using the federal funding to advertise and aggressively market to folks. So we have a lot of questions about for-profit colleges and universities, but I hope we could agree that they need to be effectively monitored and regulated. And the government needs to make sure that the government money is being invested wisely, that people aren't being misled, that we don't have unfair and aggressive marketing campaigns, as we already try to do in other industries and sectors. But it's frustrating that some of the for-profit college sector is fighting those very regulations, which is one of the reasons that I think this is an issue that it's important to talk about.
What about that, Jane? If these regulations just put them on a par in terms of standards with other institutions, and this is what the market should allow us, we should all be informed buyers. Why not say let's have everybody be held to the same standard?
Well, anybody who studies higher education recognizes that there is relatively little accountability on the part of all schools, all higher education. So, Chris, you said optimistically that the people of North Carolina are watchdogs for their university. to some extent, but by and large, many things go on in public universities and nonprofits that really shouldn't. And we have one scandal after another to show that.
Of course, but we have a government mechanism. We have a board of governors that's elected by the General Assembly. We have trustees that are appointed by elected officials. I don't have a say in who runs Strayer University or how they spend their money or who regulates them. And increasingly, I think they're going to be left on their own. So I think the state needs to do a better job, but at least there are mechanisms in place that allow us to have some input in the way decisions are made.
877-962-9862. Jeremy is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Jeremy.
Hey, how's it going, Frank?
Good. You have an observation for us, a story?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say I went to a for-profit proprietary school in Raleigh, in a higher learning school, and I have my associate's degree. And a gentleman on your panel was stating earlier, I guess he was trying to pinpoint more of like, you know, evaluating like in admissions. And so, you know, when I was introduced to the school, you know, you go through admissions and, you know, you bring your portfolio or whatever. And, you know, I guess they evaluate you, you know, your application to see if you, you know, if you can, you know, be there. You're eligible to, you know, be there.
Right.
And so it was like, you know, to me, it was like, you know, wow, like, you know, I really have to have some, you know, credentialing in my portfolio and stuff like that.
Right.
But that really wasn't the case, even though I did, you know, with my, you know, the course that I wanted to continue going there for. But see, the thing was, like, a lot of the kids that they evaluated were, you know, they just brought in, you know, portfolios that I guess were just, I guess, not so acknowledged or even really mm-hmm. looked through by the, you know, the admissions, because they just, you know, they really just wanted the money, and, you know, they were just letting these kids in here. And some of the kids were, you know, just right out of high school, and I could tell that a lot of them, you know, weren't really familiar with, you know, the courses and, you know, had very much experience.
What was your experience with the school, though? Was it a successful experience, your personal experience? You're suggesting that they might not have high standards in terms of enrollment, but once you're there, how was the education? How did it turn out for you?
It turned out pretty well. You know, I received my degree. I do still have debt that I'm trying to pay off, and but it was, I don't know.
So you were concerned about the standards coming in.
It was a bit stressful at times, and,
sure.
and I kind of felt like I was being cheated a little bit, you know, because, I mean, it was basically like $40,000, you know, for an associate's degree to go there, you know, for 2 years. I mean, that's you know, a pretty good chunk of money. And, you know, it's like, you know, I could have gone to, like, you know, college, university here in North Carolina.
Well, let me ask you that. Why didn't you? Why did you choose the private school, which cost more, over a less expensive and
because
an alternative?
Because they don't have the courses.
All right.
They don't have the courses. Like NC State, they don't have those higher learning courses. So that's where they kind of they have the upper hand on these universities that don't have those demanded courses, especially like in the creative information, you know, digital technology days, you know, digital animation, digital media, filmmaking, audio engineering, you know, that I went for. They don't have those courses, say, like at NC State.
All right, Jeremy, well, let's get a response, and thank you for your call. So, Chris, part of that, there are a couple of elements to that. One is the, you know, sort of the entry level standards, but also, you know, the market isn't responding. He needed something he couldn't get anywhere else.
Right, and nobody's talking about putting these things, all for-profit colleges, out of business, and if there are ones that do what they're supposed to do and give folks a quality education, and then that's fine. I think the question is, he does raise an issue which has been raised by a lot of critics, which is when the basis of your existence is to your bottom line and to make money, there are, without proper regulations, there are incentives to enroll as many kids as you can, as fast as you can, regardless of the ability of those kids to perform or whether or not they've met the prerequisites, whether it's with training or knowledge to be in the classes, because you want the money. And I think that is a real concern in terms of. I'm glad that certainly that Jeremy got the courses that he needed. I would say that we need to be more flexible in our community college system. There's no question about that, and keep up with the changing job requirements of an economy.
So it comes back to this question, and maybe I'll put it a different way, Jane. Shouldn't we, if there are federal dollars that are going out to these schools, shouldn't they all be somehow held to the same standard? And that might mean changing standards for nonprofits as well, standards that they're at this point not having to live up to, but maybe apply those across the board. Those are all of our dollars. Shouldn't they all be applied the same way with the same expectation of return?
Well, I don't know how extensive you think that regulation ought to be of our community colleges, but certainly in addition to the for-profits, you're suggesting that that everybody should get a lot of regulation.
Well, accountable to some standard. Look, we're laying out this money with some expectation of success. We have some expectation that the quality of this education is going to pay off. And we're not just handing it out. We're hoping that this is an investment in our future. That's why I think, roughly, why we would publicly put money into education. So we want something back for it. So for our nonprofits as well, and certainly for our state institutions, if you have a low graduation rate, we don't want to pay for you anymore.
Well, you know, there is a system called this accreditation system. And again, we also criticize it when we look at any university. Most people at universities say that the accreditation system is just essentially a cartel in which other members of the university world say, evaluate whether or not you have enough books in your library and so forth. And many of the well-known colleges in the for-profit segment also have to meet those accreditation rules. But again, it may be kind of a big joke. And unfortunately, accreditation is a very poor substitute for true accountability. And that was something that came up in the Spellings Commission about 4 or 5 years ago, which looked at all of higher education, not at for-profits. I think there's a lot that's broken and needs to be fixed. But I think that one way to start would be for the federal government to be careful about how much money it is giving to students or lending to students. That's really where the problem comes. This money is so available, and there are people who are going to get it.
We'll talk about that some more when our conversation continues. But first, I want to thank you, Chris Fitzsimon, who's the founder and director of NC Policy Watch. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jane Shaw will stay with us, president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education. And our conversation will continue on the state of things after a short break. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the future of higher education and the role that for-profit colleges play in that. In the studio with me is Jane Shaw. She's the president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. Joining us now by phone is James Morrison. He's a professor emeritus of education leadership at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
Have you an experience with a nonprofit or a for-profit? Give us a call, 877-962-9862. We're taking your calls today. James, institutions of higher education have been around, obviously, for a long time. Students' needs are changing. Do you think the nonprofit world is keeping up with the changing marketplace?
Well, there are some disruptive innovations that are appearing before our eyes that are certainly going to change the landscape of higher education, both for-profit and non-for-profit higher education. I'm thinking specifically now of what's happening with technology and online education, and particularly the experience that the Stanford professor Sebastian Thule had last fall, where he opened a class an artificial intelligence in which he'd enrolled 23 or 4 students at Stanford, but he opened it to the world. He had designed a course where the weekly exams were auto-graded and were interactive. And he said, you know, I could teach a lot of students. He got 160,000 students to enroll in this course. Now, they didn't enroll through Stanford. They just wrote him a letter saying they'd like to be in the course. I think some 23,000 students actually met all the criteria for the course, the same criteria that the Stanford students who had enrolled in the course had to have. This is called a massively open online course.
So in that sense, I mean, universities are keeping pace. They're more open to non-traditional students. They're becoming more flexible, more online courses, which was, I think, for-profits were in the vanguard a couple of decades ago when they began this stuff.
Yes, that's what's happening now. It's Stanford has joined with Princeton, Michigan, and another institution, which escapes me right now, in a sort of consortium. They have $16 million in venture capital to offer, and they're starting to offer these courses under under their corporate designation, mm-hmm. the Course Sierra, something like that. But they're all shapes and forms here. What Thule did, people did not have to register at Stanford. They didn't have to present credentials. They could just come in and take the material. 130,000 of them dropped out of the course, but the others, you know, stuck in.
Right.
Now, something else that's happened is MIT, you know, started off with this open courseware where they open their courses to anyone in the world. You know, the lecture materials, any of the materials that professors are using in those in the courses at MIT, and that started like 7 years ago or so. Is now there's an open consortium, open software consortium of schools that some 100 institutions around the world are doing the same things. Now, what has happened since then with MIT is they've formed an outfit called MITx, which actually gives certificates and has professors monitoring courses. See, the open courseware that MIT was offering, professors did not deal with the students who wanted to use the materials. The materials were used primarily by professors in other universities around the world. But MITx really changed the business model in that MIT was offering a credential, a certificate, not a degree, and not a course that could be used to apply to MIT in, although people could certainly apply to go to MIT if they wanted to, but they didn't have to have any credentials to enter the courses. It was again auto graded, but they use peer to peer instruction.
Right.
In other words, discussion list. And we're talking about masses of people, 160,000 people.
Well, you know, Jane, this all points to something that's pretty interesting in the nonprofit world when it comes to education, and that is that these schools do have to be competitive. If they spend more in a year than they bring in, they will go out of business. So to that extent, they are businesses.
Absolutely. There's a lot of competition. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so it raises the question about whether the added need for profit over and above the operating budget, right, does create these incentives for over-aggressive marketing, for perhaps cheating a little bit on the quality of the product, because now you've got shareholders to worry about over and against just your operating budget. So is this really the place? I mean, ultimately, the question, is this really the marketplace for a for-profit business, given the pressure for profit over operating expense?
Well, as I said,
I want to put this question to Jane. Thanks, Jane.
As I said earlier, the for-profit market is very diverse. I would like to share with you one particular company. One, for example, is Tutor, which is working with UNC to produce an online MBA program for which UNC will receive almost the same amount of money, $89,000, that it does now for its regular seated MBA. So there are a number of kinds of private companies, and some are working with universities. I want to also comment on how this world is changing. The professor gave some very good examples of MITx, for example, but also the Stanford professor ended up quitting Stanford, I believe, and has formed an organization of his own called Udacity because he felt he could not just continue to teach 23 or 24 students at a time when he had been able to teach thousands. So there's lots going on, and we really don't know what's going to happen. But ultimately, the price is going to become an important issue. Could I just
talk about that? Because you mentioned it a couple of times, and you've said that the price is in many ways driven by the fact that there is so much federal money available.
That's part of it, yes, absolutely. And they some companies can safely kind of work right under the cost line or the price line of other traditional universities. But there's a company called Straighterline. It's a private for-profit company, but it's not a university. It's not a college. What it does is it provides basic courses, Accounting 101, Economics 101, so forth, to students who need the credits, and then they transfer them to traditional schools for the most part. They charge $99 a month plus $39 for the course. In other words, if you could do the whole course in a month, you know, if you were by yourself on a vacation, it would cost you, what is that, $138. A tremendously less expensive situation than most courses. And that's the kind of innovation that you get from a for-profit company. And I think we're going to see a lot of it. I think we're going to see the MITx become more important because it does provide a credential. But I think we're also going to see some of these inexpensive and even free courses turning into providing some kind of a credential for students who aren't at MIT or aren't at Stanford.
Won't nonprofits have to adopt the same practices? It's not as though they've got this cumbersome, costly overhead that they can afford to keep that a private company couldn't. Isn't that true?
Yes. I don't know what they're going to do. It seems to me that online education has been kind of pioneered by these for-profits, and they know how to do it very well. We try to cover at the Pope Center what's going on in online education for more traditional students in universities, and frankly, it's not that good. There's even a pressure to charge more. I think this was at Florida State University for a course that's online. Well, that's not the way it's going to go in the future.
Let's go to the phones right now. Tom is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Tom.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, I did want to comment. I actually went to an undergraduate for-profit, and now I'm going to a state school in my graduate program. And I'm one of the very few people who I think have actually kind of done the hybrid of both the two types of schools. But one of the benefits I found from the undergraduate nonprofit was that they were able to have accept a lot more of my credits. I was one of those types of kids who had gone to a bunch of different kinds of schools before I finally kind of figured out what I wanted to do. And a lot of the non-for-profit schools, state schools that I wanted to get into were looking to compile those credits from previous schools. They were C grades or better, would not take them unless they were a B or better. Now, I'm not saying that that the C is a better grade to take, but the undergraduate for-profit school I went to did take all of my C or better grades, and the schools that I looked at trying to get into with my previous credits, some of them were expired, they wouldn't take them, they were outdated, and I kind of felt that I had earned those credits, and they were a C or better, and I did like the fact that my undergraduate for-profit school took those. And there were about 30 credits, so that was about a year total of school that I was able to capture and bring into the undergraduate for-profit program. Then and I ended up graduating with a fairly high GPA, a 3.85, and I leveraged that into a state school program. And one of the benefits of the undergraduate program for-profit school is that they are accredited, I think, the most of the for-profits undergraduate have the top accreditation. But when you look at the graduate program level for the for-profit schools, they're not as accredited. For example, AACSB, like most state schools are.
So did the nonprofit, the state school, take all of your credits from for-profit? Were you able to transfer all of those over?
Well, yeah, I graduated with a BSBM, Bachelor of Science in Business Management from the undergraduate for-profit school with a 3.85 GPA. And then I went and took my GMAT and got into the state school.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Tom.
Thank you.
877-962-9862. It gets to the credit, the question too, Jane, that I know you've talked about, which is how employers view these credits and a college education and how that has changed over time.
Yes, and I think employers are going to be very key here, because if we turn into a system where people get what are called badges, or they get these MIT credentials, which really aren't MIT, but they still have indications that someone has done the material and done it well, there could be a challenge to traditional diplomas. So I think that's one direction that we're likely to go in.
Now, you said something else earlier that I want to talk more with you about, and that is that your sense is that there's too much federal money going into education. Can we really afford to cut back on aid to education?
Well, so much of it is frankly wasted, and you see that the Pope Center is just doing a study of Pell Grants, and it turns out that. Many students receive Pell Grants, which means they don't have to pay them back, and that's good. And then they don't graduate. But we don't have very good details about that, because the Department of Education, which grants $36 billion a year in these grants, doesn't keep any record of how well the students are doing.
So does that suggest better accountability, or do you mean spend less on it?
Okay, spend less. Well, one problem is that when someone else is paying for your education, you don't take it very seriously. And if we know that with wealthy parents, sometimes their kids don't take it seriously because they know they can go. I think that the federal government is actually providing funds for students who probably shouldn't be spending the kind of money that they are. And this is in both grants and loans. They do rack up these very high debts. The average now is $25,000 for the average graduate of college, and many don't graduate. So all of this money that the federal government is either guaranteeing or providing isn't being used properly. And I think that if there were less money or more stringently offered, if there were some standards that had to be met in order to get the money, then I think everybody would be better off.
Well, I can hear you on the accountability side of it, but if you're talking about cutting the money, doesn't that mean that fewer people at the middle and lower levels of income are going to get into college? There's less money available, fewer people of lower means will get into college, and that means more people of privilege will get there. That would be a disproportionate. Could we afford that?
Well, we recommend that Pell Grants in particular go towards low-income students, not towards average students, middle-income students. I think that sometimes people will have to make choices about maybe going to the less expensive community college, and I think that the community colleges would probably benefit from that. And if they could provide a good alternative to these for-profits at a lower cost, that would be great. So far, it looks as though community colleges really need to improve their game.
James Morrison, do you think that we need better accountability standards across the board when it comes to particularly public spending on higher education?
Well, that's a loaded question, Frank. Certainly there should be more accountability, but I'd like to mention a harbinger of change called Western Governors University, which is unique right now, but I think it's going to spread, and it's a competency-based program. In other words, a student can apply to get a degree from Western Governors, and they give them a competency-based exam to see where they are with respect to their competency, and based upon that exam, they design a program of study for the student. And they can get credits from anywhere, including life experience, but online courses on traditional campuses. They have a mentor, and when they are ready to take the final competency-based exam for the degree, the students, the institution, and the society have some degree of confidence that the students who graduate from here are competent. And Western Governors is a non-for-profit, I think, institution set up by the 17 governors of the Western states. So the tuition is relatively low.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of change in the works, some of it actually motivated by the pressure and competition from for-profit universities, but a lot of it is already underway at the nonprofits, and certainly more scrutiny and change is ahead. I want to thank both of you for being on the program. James Morrison, Professor Emeritus of Education Leadership at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jane Shaw is the president of the John W. Pope Center for Higher Education Policy. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.